Next case is case number 66977, Lewis versus State of Nevada. Mr. Henderson for the appellate, and Dyke for the respondent. Ready to go.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Lawrence Van Dyke on behalf of the State of Nevada and the other petitioners in this case. Unless the Court would prefer a different approach, this is how I plan to proceed.
You're the appellant.
The appellant, Your Honor.
Yeah, and my cheat sheet is
not even confused by the new system. Yes, the appellant.
And if you want to reserve any time?
I think I'll try to reserve a couple minutes, Your Honor.
Minutes.
So unless the Court prefers a different approach, the way I plan to proceed is, first of all, I'd like to make clear and talk about for a little bit how the question before this court in this case is a question purely of state law, not of federal law, and how the federal precedents that have been cited in this case, therefore, are only persuasive to the extent that they are actually persuasive and helpful in this case, and to the extent that they track applicable state law and state regulations. And secondly, Your Honor, I'd like to talk a little bit about those federal precedents and talk about why I think that they're incomplete at best and the policy rationale that they provide. And then, of course, try to reserve a few minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor. Exhaustion in this case is a matter of state, not federal law, and I think maybe that was lost a little bit in some of the briefing, and maybe even by some of the federal courts. The U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly emphasized precisely that in multiple cases. In the Jones v. Bach case, the U.S. Supreme Court said it is the prison's requirement, and not the PLRA, that define the boundaries of proper exhaustion. And in the Woodford case cited in the briefs, the court said that the PLRA requires that, quote, prisoners must now exhaust all available remedies, not just those that meet federal standards. So the whole purpose of the PLRA is to require exhaustion of all, complete exhaustion of all remedies, including state remedies, governed by state law, and not just state standards, not just federal standards. And that's why, for example, when I'm up at the Ninth Circuit arguing a 1983 case, a case that's federal law, in federal court, the Ninth Circuit panel is still very interested in whether or not the prisoner actually exhausted the state remedies that are governed by state standards. For example, I've had cases where they've actually wanted to know, did they file a second level grievance, something that's only required by the administrative regulations, AR 740. And the reason they want to know, and if they didn't file their second level grievance, if they didn't exhaust their state remedies, which is governed by state standards, then they will dismiss the case. So the issue before this case is purely a matter of state law. And the question is, did under Nevada's ARs and the governing statute, UNIOS, fail to properly and completely exhaust his grievance, his claims by filing his grievance after the deadline set forth by AR 740.05? And I think to answer that question, this court should look at the text of the relevant regulations and of two particular statutes. So I'd like to run through that with the court. AR 740.05, subsection 4, says the inmate shall file an informal grievance within 6 months, including for civil rights. Subsection 8 says failure to do that shall constitute abandonment of the inmate's grievance at this and all subsequent levels. Now, I think it's very clear language. And in the 2014 Brothers case, this court said it equated abandonment with failure to exhaust. It said that the inmate's, quote, grievance was deemed abandoned, and as a result, he failed to exhaust his administrative remedies. Now, that's an unpublished case. I'm not citing it as binding on this court, but I am citing it just to show that courts regularly equate abandonment, that kind of language, abandonment with failure to exhaust. In fact, the Ninth Circuit's done it repeatedly. Also, the Tanius versus IRS case in 1990 did that, and also cites other cases that did that.
What do you do with subparagraph B of paragraph 8 of the regulation, which says the grievance response shall note that the inmate exceeded the time frame and no action will be taken? That wasn't followed here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, is that in, that's 740, is that right? In subparagraph
yes.
B.
8B.
I'm sorry, 8B?
8B.
Okay. And the grievance response will note that the inmate exceeded and no action will be taken. Right. So I think it, when the prison should not respond to the grievance, just like, as I'll get to in a second here, that this court, I think, under applicable statutes, should dismiss the claim. In fact, the applicable statute says shall dismiss the claim. But, of course, prisons aren't perfect. Nobody's perfect. And so sometimes I think they make
mistakes. Did the prison respond to the claim?
Yes, they responded to the claim twice, I think, on the merits. And so that's the issue in this case, is what does that do when the prison responds to the claim? And I think under the AR, it doesn't say you abandon the claim, but not if the prison responds to the claim. It says you've abandoned the claim. So I think even under the AR itself, they've abandoned the claim. But I think also under the statute that the ARs were promulgated under, which is 209, 243, it also says that, quote, the claim must be filed within 6 months after the date of the alleged loss, damage, or injury. So again, I think very kind of put the lens. But I think what is particularly persuasive in this case, so those two, that administrative regulation language and the statutory language of 209, I think would be binding not just on in the state court system, but in the federal court system, as I discussed earlier, isn't it? But there's another statute, and that's the statute.
Also, earlier you said we should not be concerned with the federal law, only the state law.
But
by invoking, what is it? You can't have it both ways.
No, what I'm saying is that the federal courts would be concerned about state law. I'm not saying you should be concerned about the federal, but the federal courts would actually be bound by those statutes too. But I think there's a separate statute that is binding on this court, that governs this court's jurisdiction, that I don't think the federal courts would necessarily be bound by, but this court has different, just like, you know, if you bring a 1983 claim in the federal system, you might have a different time to answer as in the state system, right? So there's different procedural rules that might govern in that context. In Nevada, NRS 41.0322 governs this court's jurisdiction for these type of claims. And it says, in subsection 1, that's NRS 41.0322, it says that the Department of Corrections may not proceed with any action against, or an inmate in the Department of Corrections may not proceed with any action against the department unless the person has exhausted the person's administrative remedies provided by 209-243. And it specifically says to this court and to the Nevada courts in subsection 3, the court shall dismiss the action if the person's not timely filed the person's administrative claim pursuant to NRS 209-243. Now, the Court of Appeals recognized, I think, that if NRS 41.0322 applies, then it would require the court to dismiss the claim. In fact, if you recall, the Court of Appeals actually dismissed the state court claim because of NRS 41.0322. But what it did is it said that NRS 41.0322 doesn't apply to 1983 claims, only applies to state tort claims. The problem with that, Your Honor, is that NRS 41.0322 broadly references all claims covered by 41.031, which is Nevada's waiver of sovereign immunity statute. And nothing, if you look at 031, nothing in there limits it to only state claims. And in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1990, in the Hallett case, made it very clear that a state can't waive sovereign immunity only for state claims, but not an analogous 1983 claim.
So you would be urging that we reject Berry versus Fail on that point?
I think Berry versus Fail is clearly wrong, Your Honor. I think Berry versus Fail doesn't really, if you read Berry versus Fail and then you read the Court of Appeals decision here, it doesn't provide any rationale as to why 41.0322 doesn't apply to 1983 claims. Nevada has to waive immunity for 1983 claims. That's very clear from the Hallett case. There's no other language that waives sovereign immunity for 1983 claims. And the language of 41.031, is very broad language. There's nothing in it that limits it to only state tort claims. I think it applies to constitutional torts just as much as any other state tort. And actually, it creates serious problems, I think, if this court was to read it as not covering. Under the Hallett case, under the U.S. Supreme Court's Hallett, 1990 Hallett case, it creates problems because what happened in the Hallett case is the court said you can't waive sovereign immunity for analogous state tort claims, which is exactly what you have here. I mean, you've got the very same actions, he brought two different claims, a state tort claim and a federal 1983 constitutional tort claim. And what happened is the Court of Appeals said, well, we think that 41.031 covers the state claim, and therefore 41.0322 requires it to be dismissed, but we don't think that covers the 1983 claim. There's nothing in the text to allow that, Your Honor. So, Your Honor, just be clear, in the habeas context, this court has already addressed this sort of thing, I think. In habeas context, you have a similar statute that has very similar language to 41.0322. And it says that in the Pellegrini case, this court in 2001 read language shall dismiss petition, which sounds very much like shall dismiss the action, as mandatory, and rejected the argument that this court could review a defaulted habeas claim even where the district court had had waived the default and addressed the merits of the claim. And so, you know, the argument here is that, well, the prison has waived the default and addressed the claim. But even where the district court has waived the default in a habeas context, this court has said this type of language does not allow the court to have jurisdiction. And even farther, in the Haverstraw case 2 years later in 2003, it said even where the state, as the other party, has stipulated to disregard the default, this court still does not have jurisdiction. And so I think if the court was to do the same thing in a habeas context, in this context as it's done in the habeas context, if it reads the language the same way, then this is very clear and it's governed by, I think, the text of the applicable Nevada statutes and ARs. Now, I will just very briefly, Your Honor, explain it. In the Reed Bay case, the Sixth Circuit case, and the other federal cases that it talked about why, this policy reason why you shouldn't have exhaustion if, like here, the prison answers the claim on the merits. In the Reed Bay case, the court talked about a couple of rationales governing why we have the PLRA, and it took those rationales from the Woodford case. And those rationales were, one, by having the prison address the claim first, it has gives the prison system a chance to address it first, and then secondly, it creates a record for the courts to review. And it said, hey, those two reasons, if the prison has already addressed the claim on the merits, even though the claim is untimely, those two rationales would seem to be met, and so therefore the PLRA, it makes sense as a policy matter to allow the courts to hear the claim even though it was filed out of time. The problem with that is that I think that's only half or less of the reasons that Woodford actually provided. The Woodford case also talks about other key reasons, such as that exhaustion discourages disregard of the agency's procedures. That's another reason that the PLRA exists. And here, it's hard to imagine that if you allow these kind of claims to go forward, why would it not encourage inmates to disregard the prison's procedures on timeliness? If you're a prisoner and you've got a claim that you've blown the 6 months and you're thinking, should I bring this claim or not? You think, well, if I get lucky and a busy overworked caseworker happens to overlook my grievance, overlook my timeliness and actually decides the grievance, then you know, I'll get to take it to court. And not just that, but let's say the first caseworker actually catches it and says no and denies it on timeliness, as Your Honor said, and under 8B. But then you just refile it, and hopefully a different caseworker you kind of slips through. Well, that's exactly one of the key reasons why the PLR exists. And Woodford, on page 89 of that decision, it says exhaustion discourages disregard. That's never discussed by any of the federal courts. It's the federal courts basically took some of the rationales from Woodford and didn't take others. Now, to be clear, I don't think there's another rationale, but I don't think it's necessary to get into that, but I don't think that this court even needs to get into those, because this court only needs to get into the policy area if it doesn't think the legislature has already answered the question for this court by the plain text of the statute, I think. And I think it is plainly answered by...
There are extenuating circumstances, though, that could be shown to justify not having exhausted, correct? There's some suggestion in the brief that Mr. Munoz was
literacy.
In solitary confinement and had troubles with literacy and access to information needed to pursue this. I don't see record sites for that, but this came up on a motion to dismiss, correct?
I think, yes, and I think those particular claims I didn't see in the court, but I think those claims have been raised since, so I just don't think they're before this court.
Well, but you have a petition for judicial review by an inmate who is showing that it was reached on the merits by the prison system, correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
Doesn't that raise a question of fact as to why and how that occurred, even apart from the Sixth Circuit and other cases?
Well, I think it was his response. You, under the PLRA, there's exceptions under the PLRA, and we're not arguing that those exceptions can't apply. But I don't think those arguments were made below at all, Your Honor.
I don't think they were either. But just facially on this record, it's of concern to me, because now we're getting arguments on appeal that there were extenuating circumstances, and that's why the prison reached this on the merits.
Well, I don't. I think those are brand new arguments. Obviously, they're not briefed at all. And I think that those arguments should have been raised in one of the proceedings below, either in the district court or in the court of appeals. And I just don't think they're before the court. I think the record's actually very clean in this case. It provides the court with a way to address this issue on a very clean record and to address it, a very important issue, but I think a very narrow issue, and that is, if they address it on the merits, if the prison addresses it on the merits, do they need to? Does that somehow waive the failure to exhaust? And I think it doesn't, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Hello, Your Honors. I would actually like to start off with that issue. He is correct. That was not on the record. I was not the attorney and did not have the opportunity to set it out. And I think the best way to address that issue, though, is to look at it as a hypothetical. Acknowledge, okay, we don't have the evidence for it, but it really does show the problem that happens when we have an issue that's decided on the merits at the administrative level with no record established of why they waived their procedural argument, is that those things do not come out. I included those facts to make this point. It very well may have been that the prison administrator was aware of that and that it was because of that they allowed this to go through. And because they made that decision, we're now deprived of that record. I think that this case ends up becoming a lot like reflecting a lot in a lot of ways our judicial system, which is that when an argument is not raised below, there's not the ability for it to come up again. And I think that brings us to what is really being missed in the state's argument here. And that is that we're not challenging the fact that Mr. Munoz filed late. No question about that. And we're not challenging the fact that that is the correct construction of the statute. The issue is that after that point, it was still decided on its merits, and that any procedural defense by a federal statute is governed. I'm sorry, I'm having still very new to this. So the statute in question is certainly a state, but this is a federal claim. And when the state and when the administrative agency decided to waive their rights under the state statute, that developed a federal defense because pursuant to Supreme Court precedent, federal claims are viable.
Mr. Henderson, may I interrupt you
please,
a moment? Mr. Van Dyke urges this court to revisit and reverse Berry. That was a critical part of the Court of Appeals decision, that this court had made a distinction between state law claims and 1983 claims. I don't recall, but I'm going to go back and look again, the state asking us to reverse Berry in its briefs. Do you recall that? And then as a separate question, should we revisit that question or not?
Thank you. I do not believe that they did. And I would urge the court not to. And I believe that also takes us down another road, which is the question of whether or not the policy argument that is put forward by the state is really an appropriate one. And that was kind of what I was trying to get out before, is that the policy argument that's been put forward is the idea that the agency should be able to keep peace in the prison by hearing claims on the merits no matter how they are submitted. That takes a huge leap of faith, because it also at the same time says that every time that those claims are going to be heard on their merits, they'll be cut off from review if there's a procedural error. So we have to assume that that's not going to create new problems within the prison population itself. It also takes a leap of judgment of why it is that For instance, in this decision, in this matter, the prison's review of the matter was really only about two sentences. We spoke with the person. They saw that they said that it wasn't done correctly. That really doesn't vary too much from a procedural rejection anyway. And so I think that what you come down to is that that argument does not really hold out in practicality. But what this, what the actual effect of this would be is that it would allow agencies to be making merit-based decisions and then not have those merit-based decisions be subject to judicial review, which I don't think is, I don't think was ever the intention of the legislature. If you look at the facts that both Nevada, that both the statutes of Nevada and the federal statutes both provide for a procedure for judicial review. And frankly, I just don't think that it's good policy, and it is not in keeping with our judicial tradition generally.
This policy argument raises an odd question here for me. Suppose the facts of this case, but the administrative agency agrees with Munoz and says you should be granted relief because that determination was made late. I guess we would disregard it. I don't know where one would be. Would the state remedy that they agreed to make be invalid? What becomes of a grant of that authority?
Well, certainly the state would be, the state would have the same, would have the same rights as the prisoner would have.
If we adopt the state's position,
oh, I see.
Then they would be in a position to agree with the prisoner's complaint or grievance, but disregard it because it had been filed late, I guess is the position the state urges on us here. What say you about that?
I would say that you are correct, and then it creates the same issue that I was setting out before, is the entire idea of how our justice system is set up, and more importantly, how our statutes are set up, is that any decision at an agency level is to be subject to judicial review. And so, just as in state court, a judge proceeded to hear all arguments presented before him, I would only be able to come up to you and then argue based on those arguments. To allow the prisoner, to, in this case, to be subject to the state, or vice versa, coming in and introducing brand new arguments and cutting off the review of the decision that was made, would deprive the statutes of their intent and would deprive the whatever party is being appealed against of justice.
I'd like to return to a question I asked you earlier. Mr. Van Dyke argues that the source of the application of 410.322 is the state's waiver of sovereign immunity in the previous statute 41, and I forgot the number. What about that argument? Did Barry get it wrong? Should we revisit that, even though maybe that wasn't specifically requested here? Is Barry an aberration in the country from the way one approaches the sovereign immunity doctrine waiver?
I'm afraid that having not been requested in the brief, I did not prepare to discuss that, and I'd be taking a guess.
Thank you.
Mr. Henderson? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Mr. Henderson, at what point did you think it would have been appropriate for Mr. Munoz to make the record that he was either, perhaps in, because he was in solitary confinement or otherwise illiterate? Did the state's failure or the prison's failure to let him know that his application was untimely deprive him of that opportunity to make the record?
Yes, I certainly do think so. I must concede that had it been done correctly, he should have also brought that up at the district court level. This was a pro se litigant, and so I think that but it still brings us back to the same point. I mean, he definitely should have brought it up at the district court level, at the district court level to bring it to the attention of the court that there was that lacking. But it still brings us to the same idea of will that cut it off? Are there extenuating circumstances that have to be reviewed below? And when that, you know, just like it is, we are sitting here in the Supreme Court not having that full record, the district court in that case would not have that full record because the administrative agency would never have been able to make a record of whether or not they were aware of it.
Does it matter if we don't revisit Berry? If the 1983 claim is a separate claim, does it matter?
I'm not sure, though I will say that I believe in that the position that we set out in our brief is that because of the fact that Section 1983 is a federal statute, and because what is really at issue here is not the interpretation of the administrative regulation, but rather the fact that the regulation was never even addressed, that at that point you have a defense which is federal in nature and has federal precedent, which federal precedent is controlling for Section 1983. But I would also go on to urge the court, based on the policy issues that I've very jumbly set out, to apply this to the state action as well, because I do believe that it is in the interest of justice that merit-based decision is not being slated for review.
Well, Mr. Henderson, if they had simply responded that it was an untimely petition and not reached the issue on the merits, that certainly is not capable of review. Under policy, if they had denied it for untimeliness but then reached it on the merits for purposes of peace or explanation for the prisoner, you think that should be capable of review?
No, I would say I do not. I think at the point where, and I think that would be the ideal answer to the state's policy argument is if what you are trying to do is appease the prisoners by making them understand what really happened in the prison, to go both routes, to set out in the record, allow any excuses or any extenuating circumstances to come forward at the same time as setting out why it is that whatever they perceived to be a mistake was not a mistake.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Van Vecka, we'll round it off to a minute. You have a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Real quick, in response to your question, Justice Hardesty, I think that because Berry versus Peel involves a jurisdictional question, I think this court can and indeed has a duty to actually, if this court doesn't have jurisdiction, then it has a duty to look into that itself. So whether or not it was raised by the parties.
You didn't raise that in your brief.
I do know it was litigated below, but I do not recall whether it was raised in the petition. And I think the part of that may be because of the oddness of a petition for review thing where you're just trying to raise the issue. We think that this sort of like a cert petition. We're trying to raise the issue that will hook this court and get them excited about the issue. But I do think that this court can, and in the Haverstraw case that I cited to from the habeas context, 2003, recall that this court said in the habeas context, very similar language, that even where the state has stipulated that this court still had the follow-up.
Since you've raised this question, Mr. Van Dyke, is the Berry case an aberration in dealing with waiver of sovereign immunity? Berry says that a 1983 claim is different, survives. Is that an aberration in the country?
Usually this question comes up in the other context where a state system doesn't want to hear 1983 claims, so they say, we're not waiving sovereign immunity for 1983 claims. And the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't said you can't wait. The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't really answered the question of whether you can just say we're not waiving sovereign immunity for 1983 claims. So what they've said is basically an equal treatment rule. You can't say we don't waive sovereign immunity for 1983 claims, but we are going to waive sovereign immunity for analogous state tort claims. And so here we clearly waive sovereign immunity for analogous state tort claims. I mean, this case proved it, right? We have one state claim, we have a 1983 claim. So the question, so we clearly have to waive sovereign immunity. And my point is just that, well, where do we waive sovereign immunity? The only place would be in that 41.031 statute, and there's nothing in the text. I would urge the court to go look at that statute. There's nothing in the text that says, oh, we're only waiving sovereign immunity for state claims. And, of course, if we did that, that would be a constitutionally problematic to interpret it as such. And the only other, I'll leave it there. I'm already out of time. Thank you very much.
The court thanks both attorneys for their arguments in this matter and the briefs. Also, the court wants to thank Senior Justice Shearing for sitting in with us. Welcome back to Carson City, Justice Shearing. This matter will stand.